Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 12th of May, these are our main stories. Israel defiant despite widespread international criticism of its military operation against Hamas in the Gazan city of Rafah. Meanwhile, the winner of this year's controversial Eurovision final has been announced. More on this later. And in Georgia, tens of thousands protest against a law which they say would silence independent media. Also in this podcast...
No excuse for violent men! 1, 2, 3, 4, we won't take it anymore!
What's driving the high levels of violence against women in Australia? The head of the European Council, Charles Michel, has become the latest international figure to urge Israel to respect humanitarian law and hold back on a ground invasion of the southern Gazan city of Rafah. For their part, the Israelis say they're pressing ahead with plans to destroy what they claim are Hamas's last remaining units in Gaza and that they're killing lots of fighters. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari speaks for Israel's army.
So far, we've eliminated dozens of terrorists in the eastern part of Rafah. We've found a significant underground route with lots of weapons. We've repeated the temporary evacuation of the population in several other parts of eastern Rafah, which are close to the area of combat. Hamas will continue to try and restore its military capabilities, and we will be required to act to dismantle them.
There is no way to verify the Israeli claims. President Biden has said a ceasefire would be possible if Hamas freed the hostages it's holding. Meanwhile, the Israeli army has ordered tens of thousands of people in the eastern part of Rafah to seek sanctuary in a narrow coastal strip. These two people are in Rafah.
The safe areas they're talking about are completely unsafe and not suitable for habitation at all. There is no electricity available, no water, no health system. Also, the so-called safe areas have been hit and targeted since the start of the war. We either go to the safe areas to get hit there or simply stay here and die.
We've been trying to leave since early morning, but we've no idea where to go. Should we go to Khan Yunis or Mawasi Rafah or Mawasi Khan Yunis? The streets are packed, traffic everywhere with everyone in the streets. Things are difficult and we've no clue where to go.
I heard more from our Middle East correspondent, Yoland Nell.
Panic and desperation have really set in. There were Israeli airstrikes, there was shelling reaching the centre of Rafah from the east. That terrified a lot of people. And then these new evacuation orders affecting parts of the city that were previously crammed with displaced Gazans. Now locals say that these look like a ghost town, and it does really seem that Israeli forces are set to push in towards the heart of the city. Now, Israel is saying that about 300,000 Palestinians have left. The UN figure's lower. We can't really verify that. But it's no doubt there is a real humanitarian crisis in Rafah. Apart from about 150,000 litres of fuel that came in a day ago, UN officials say that there's really been no entry of food or water or medicine because of the closure of the two crossings into southern Gaza, Rafah and Israeli-controlled Kerem Shalom, which Israel says has seen Hamas rocket fire aimed at it today. And that's really cut the strip off from outside. There are very few supplies now for people available.
And while Rafah remains the focus of the world's attention, there have been developments in other parts of Gaza too.
Definitely. So Israel's said it's carried out dozens of airstrikes across the length of the strip in the past day, adding that its ground troops had eliminated fighters in Zeitoun outside of Gaza City. We've been hearing from people on the ground that at least 24 were killed in the central Gaza Strip, including women and children in airstrikes there. Their funerals have been taking place. An Israeli airstrike killed at least seven people in a house in Bet Lahia in the north of the Gaza Strip, all from the same family, Palestinian medics say. And it's worth noting that Israeli forces also deployed to Jabalia, north of Gaza City. They put out more evacuation orders for that area as well. And this is somewhere that previously the Israeli military had announced that it had defeated Hamas battalions. And it's being sort of read very much as a sign of, you know, the dangers of there not being a proper post-war strategy for governance to permanently replace Hamas in Gaza, a sign too that Hamas is not a spent force.
And for all the external pressure on Israel to hold back from a full-blown invasion of Rafah, it doesn't seem to be having all that much effect on Benjamin Netanyahu.
Certainly, it's not clear whether this will be a full-scale invasion at the moment of the kind that the world has been warning against. Although, as we've been hearing already, the humanitarian consequences are dire. There is footage that shows there are more Israeli tanks and troops massed on the border that could come in if this offensive was widened further. The Israeli Prime Minister has been saying that Israel is ready to do it alone if it has to. He's been striking a defiant tone in the past week. We just don't know how much the reports that have come from the US, the repeated messages and warnings that it's giving are having an effect behind the scenes.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, after protests and controversy, the winner of the 68th Eurovision Song Contest in Sweden has been announced. It's Switzerland. That was Nemo singing The Code. The competition was marred by divisions over Israel's involvement, which sparked pro-Palestinian demonstrations in the city of Malmo, where Eurovision was held. At one point, though, when the votes came in, Israel's Eden Golan was in the lead. She finished fifth with 375 points, but it was Switzerland and Nemo's night, taking 591 points. Mariam Mashiri is in Malmo covering the extravaganza.
I love being here, and one of the reasons I love being here is because the atmosphere is amazing. And here at the Media Centre tonight, the atmosphere was 100% electric. The music was brilliant, the songs were amazing. After a week of high drama and high controversy, at last it all boiled down to who sang the best song according to the juries and who sang the best song according to audiences. And yes, as you mentioned already, the winner, Switzerland, winning actually by a good margin over Croatia, which came second, and France, which came third. It was an amazing competition, and Nemo, the Swiss act, they were absolutely brilliant. They literally won the majority of all the jury votes, and they ended up coming first. It was a nail-biting final couple of seconds when you saw the split screen and you saw Croatia and you saw Switzerland. Switzerland needed 183 points from the audience vote to win the competition, and they got that, and they were so pleased. But look, I have another amazing act here, Charlotte Gallagher, the BBC's arts correspondent. And look, it has been a tough week, hasn't it? It's been a really difficult week for the EBU, who organised the competition. But tonight, the music really spoke for itself, didn't it?
It did. I mean, the performances on stage were incredible, and at times it seemed like all the kind of controversy had been forgotten, like when we saw Switzerland, France did an incredible performance, Ukraine, Ireland. I mean, there were some moments there was booing again in the audience tonight for the Israeli act, and also for the executive director of Eurovision. He was loudly booed at points, which I think is the first time that's happened, and I think it's the crowd have been so annoyed with how they feel some parts of the event have been mismanaged, and also with Joost Klein being kicked out from the Netherlands.
Well, that was it. I think he was booed, I think, because of the Netherlands issue, right?
Yes. So Joost Klein, very, very popular entrant, a real fan favourite, Europapa, Europapa, Europa. So they were removed from the contest, essentially. There was an incident backstage involving a member of production crew. Now, the Dutch broadcaster said what happened was Joost Klein didn't want to be filmed, and he made what they're saying a threatening movement towards his camera person. And because of that, he was kicked out of the competition. The Dutch broadcaster has said that was completely disproportionate and it shouldn't have happened. And actually, in the Media Centre, I noticed that some of the Dutch journalists had Justice for Yoast on top of their laptops. And like you said, in fact, the Eurovision executive director had to read out the Netherlands' points because the Netherlands refused to even read out the points they'd given to other acts because they're so angry that Joost Klein was essentially kicked out.
OK, so the controversy continued, but it's all over now. Switzerland are the winners of the 68th Eurovision Song Contest. Charlotte, thank you very much indeed. So, look, the big question now is Switzerland next year. Which city will they be hosting it in? Whereabouts is it going to be hosted? And will the BBC send me once again to Eurovision?
Mariam Mashiri. Another mass public protest has been taking place in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, against controversial draft legislation that would force non-governmental organisations to declare foreign funding. Opponents say the bill, which they're calling the Russian law, as it mirrors similar legislation approved in Moscow, would silence critical voices in civil society and independent media. The governing Georgian Dream Party says it's needed for transparency. I asked our correspondent in Tbilisi, Rehan Dimitri, what the authorities meant when they spoke of transparency.
A lot of people want to hear an answer to it, because if it was just about transparency of funding that these organizations receive, then why would they need labeling these organizations? Because part of this proposed bill is that these civil society organizations and independent media, they would have to declare themselves as an organization serving the interest of a foreign power. And this is the second attempt by the Georgian government to introduce this legislation, which largely remains unchanged from last year. And last year it was called the Foreign Agents Law. And it was cancelled last year in the face of mass protest. And that's exactly what we're seeing this time around. I'm standing now on the embankment of the river here in Tbilisi. And about 5 minutes ago, luckily now the crowd moved. There's so many people, absolutely like sea of people, thousands and thousands on both sides of the embankment moving towards Tbilisi's Europe Square. And what's happening today is perhaps like one of the final attempts by the protesters to make their government listen to them. These protests, they've been going on for over 3 weeks now. But judging by what the Prime Minister of this country said yesterday when he met some media representatives, they're pushing for this law and they want to adopt it on Monday.
Isn't the real issue here a political struggle between pro- and anti-Russian forces in Georgia?
Well, what this struggle, as you know, so many people that we've been talking to over the past few weeks, this struggle is for Georgia's European future, because they really fear that this slightly window of opportunity that Georgia has as a candidate country to join the EU, and they got this status just last year, they're worried that with the adoption of this law, they will lose this opportunity. And that's what has been bringing so many people out to the streets.
Rehan Dimitri in Tbilisi. Ukraine has disputed claims that it's lost control of five villages to Russian troops who have crossed the border into the northeastern region of Kharkiv. The assault has created a new front in the war that has been largely waged in the east and south of the country. Ukrainian officials have acknowledged that heavy fighting is continuing, but say the situation is under control. However, is this the start of an anticipated Russian summer offensive? Our Kyiv correspondent James Waterhouse has this report.
For the last 2 years, living close to the Ukraine-Russia border means frequent airstrikes. But this week was different. Alexei, a police officer, posted this video from the town of Vovchansk. Shelling has intensified. The situation is tense, he says. So we urge people to evacuate or stay in shelters. Many chose to do the former. Grandma, you all right? Where's your daughter? He asks. Alexei and his team help locals with their shopping bags of belongings into his vehicle. Inna is one of those who had to escape.
Everything was smashed. Everything was in ruins. All night long, there was smoke all around, a haze. You cannot recognize Vovchansk that used to be there.
It was a morning when Russian bombs rained down on Vovchansk before several small Russian units tried to advance in armored vehicles closer to the border. Volunteer Olena helped some of the 3,000 population escape.
It wasn't very loud, but we were driving fast, so we didn't hear it. The whole horizon was covered in black and white smoke. Everything was burning there.
We managed to get hold of the Vovchansk mayor, Tomas Gambarashvili, who described the bombardment as unprecedented.
The situation has become much worse. The majority of people have left in their own cars. Now we're helping residents who are unable to leave on their own.
Russia's momentum has seen its ambitions grow over the past 6 months. Whilst still defiant, President Zelensky acknowledges the perilous state of his Kharkiv region.
Today, Russian troops tried to expand operations against Ukraine. We understand the scope of the occupiers' forces. We see their plan. Our soldiers, our artillery, our drones respond to the occupier.
Few in Western circles are currently thinking cities like Kharkiv could fall to Russia. Recent history points to Moscow's last failed attempt with a larger, better-trained force. But as Pavlo Lakichuk, a Kyiv security analyst, explains, mobilized Russian troops are not to be dismissed.
Those Russians still have combat experience. But to capture a city such as Kharkiv is one thing. Holding it would require even greater forces. The Russians always have complex aims, one of which is to sow panic.
And for towns like Vovchansk, the closer invading troops get, the more acute that fear becomes, despite the efforts of officers like Alexei. It's 6 p.m, he says, and the situation is more or less stable. But the shelling continues.
James Waterhouse there. Still to come in the Global News Podcast. The Italian island where goats outnumber humans and what it's doing to redress the balance. Funerals have been held in northern Afghanistan for victims of devastating flash floods that swept away hundreds of homes in villages across several provinces. The United Nations says more than 300 people were killed in Friday's floods, which were triggered by intense rain. Dozens are still unaccounted for. Most of the casualties occurred in Baghlan province. Images on social media show roaring rivers of mud, water and stones ripping through villages. Gul Agha, who lives in Baghlan, said everything happened very quickly.
It was 1:30 p.m. local time. We had finished Friday prayers and were walking toward our homes when suddenly the flood started. We didn't have enough time to reach our homes. The flood took us by surprise. There was a lot of destruction and many people lost their lives. The flood carried away some children, cars, and lots of people's belongings.
Timothy Anderson heads up the UN's World Food Programme in Afghanistan. He described the efforts of aid workers in the region.
It's a tricky place to work. This morning, all humanitarian agencies have met with the Afghanistan National Disaster Management Authority. There have been 7 joint assessment teams that have been deployed to the various locations to understand, do rapid needs assessments, understand the extent of damage and need, and then to inform the resultant response. We don't wait for that. So WFP has initiated our emergency response already to do an immediate blanket food assistance to affected communities. In terms of distributions to date, within the next hour, the first community will be reached with emergency food assistance. In other locations, because of access issues, flood damaged roads, still flooding in existence, we need to offload food into different modes of transport, including putting them on the backs of donkeys to be able to cross paths that vehicles can't traverse. So by this evening, we will have reached the most affected locations with an initial emergency food response.
Bilal Sawari, the BBC's former correspondent in Afghanistan, has been monitoring developments.
The impact of these flash floods is simply devastating. Families are still looking for their loved ones, even if someone finds the body of his child or a family member. That is considered a success. So that gives you an idea how tragedy has struck some of the poorest of those people. The worst areas hit are Borka, Nahrin, and central Baghlan. This is a province that is known for its watermelons, melons, and rice. So this was a time of the year that farmers were cultivating that. Given the harsh economic realities, the impact will be heartbreaking at a village district level in terms of the economy. But what is also sad when you see a young girl crying helplessly, asking for her parents while, you know, they have vanished, their affairs, they are dead. She doesn't have a chance as a girl to go to school. She's not only robbed of her childhood by war and destruction, but also this time by natural disasters. And it was very interesting for me to see a video on social media where a Taliban official is inside his vehicle and he's asking people, what village is this? He does not even bother to get out of the vehicle. So some Afghans have castigated that, but given the slow response of the authorities, you know, given the fact that there was snowfall and flash floods in western and southwestern Afghanistan, I would say this is a failure on the part of the authorities.
Bilal Sawari, the BBC's former correspondent in Afghanistan. Violence against women has become a national crisis in Australia, according to Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. On average this year, a woman has died at the hands of someone known to them once every 4 days. So what's driving this? Katie Watson has been investigating.
Australian police say the attacker that fatally stabbed 6 people at a Sydney mall may have been targeting women.
A young single mother has been murdered in her own home.
The headlines keep coming.
No excuse for violent men.
And the voices calling for an end to the killing are getting louder.
1, 2, 3, 4, we won't take it anymore.
Last month, thousands of people in cities across Australia marched to call for more laws to protect women. So far this year, 28 women have been killed by someone known to them. That's according to data compiled by the Counting Dead Women Project. That's twice as many as this time last year.
Society and Australia must do better. We need to change the culture, we need to change attitudes.
The pressure is on for Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. Earlier this month, he announced around £500,000 of financial support for those fleeing domestic violence. Janie Morris is a survivor. She recently benefited from the programme. While the announcement was a good thing, she said the government didn't actually announce anything new. They just kept a programme going that otherwise would have been shelved.
It is very clear that Australia is going through a domestic violence crisis beyond anything we've ever experienced before. And I don't think that the government really knows how to deal with this properly, because the reality is there's no one fix to ending gendered violence. There's not.
More and more schools are starting to run workshops about consent and respectful relationships, and the government's putting more resources into protecting children online.
Okay, anyone else want to give us a sexist joke?
Facilitator Ethan West is talking to a class of teenagers in northern Sydney. Most are looking slightly uncomfortable.
Do any porn videos start off with a relationship where they talk about feelings, where they talk about consent?
Several of the students we spoke to said they felt nervous about growing up in Australia. Kaya is 16 years old.
Well, we're kind of shocked that it's still happening, you know. We're in the 21st century. You'd think that by now there's so many new technologies and there's so many new advances in society, but yet this is still something that's happening.
There's no doubt there's a renewed sense of urgency to address gender violence in this country. It's not new, but it's persistent. And many are asking what it really takes to see concrete change.
Katie Watson with that report. King Charles's youngest son, Prince Harry, has met wounded soldiers with his wife Meghan on the second day of their 3-day visit to Nigeria. The Duke of Sussex played in a volleyball match in Abuja with injured ex-servicemen and women. Two of them said that the Invictus Games for Wounded Armed Forces personnel, which the Duke co-founded, helped them overcome the challenges they faced.
I normally hide my injury. When I see one or two people like this, I will hide my injury. I don't want anybody to even know that I'm even both leg amputated. But since I joined up with Nigerian Conquer, Nigerian V2, I feel free.
Today is one of the happiest days of my life.
I'm blessed, because whoever, or me, whoever think that a disabled person, an amputee, a female, will wake up one day and see that she's been watched by the Prince of England here in Nigeria. Oh, my God.
Simi Jaloso is covering the event.
Well, the Duke and Duchess have had a pretty busy second day here in Abuja. They started off by meeting members of a local organisation that they support called Nigeria Unconquered, which helps wounded and injured service members and veterans, a cause that we know is close to Prince Harry's heart. There, he actually took part in a sitting volleyball game with the team, and they were really enthusiastic. They were chanting, Team Harry, Team Harry. And afterwards, he and Meghan spoke to the families of those athletes. One girl offered Meghan a bouquet of roses, to which Meghan gave her a rose back and said that she was really happy to be there. And then afterwards, they attended a reception that was hosted by the Ministry of Defence. That ministry is behind their visit to Nigeria in the first place. The Duke of Sussex gave a kind of recap of his visit to a military rehab hospital yesterday. He said when he was there, he met 50 injured soldiers that were lying in their beds, and he said he could feel a sort of low morale in the room. But two of the soldiers stood out to him because they were smiling. He said one of them was even doing push-ups, and that visit kind of reminded him of why he started the Invictus Games Foundation. Afterward, the Duchess Meghan, she attended a Women in Leadership event where she co-hosted with the Director General of the World Trade Organization, Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, and there she spoke about her Nigerian heritage. And the day she found out that she was 43% Nigerian, she said she was really happy, and the first thing she did was call her mother, and she just said that she was happy to be in the country and to find out more about her heritage as well as interact with other Nigerians. When she was asked whether she would come back, she said absolutely.
Simi Jaloso reporting from Abuja. When a small island in Italy offered people free goats, they weren't expecting much of a response. The animals had become a nuisance. Locals wanted them off their hands. But 2,000 people applied to adopt one, with offers coming from as far as Nigeria, as Harry Bly reports.
Alicudi is a small volcanic island that's a 2 to 3 hour boat ride from mainland Sicily. It has a population of around 100 people and 600 feral goats. And it's this disproportionate number that's caused concern for its mayor, Riccardo Gullo. They were originally brought to Alicudi by farmers. There was a time when these goats lived a secluded life, away from humans, on the mostly uninhabited and rocky far side of the island. But over the years, their numbers have multiplied, and residents have reported the caprine creatures ruining their gardens, eating vegetables from their allotments, and even coming into their homes. So the mayor came up with his goat adoption initiative, and it became an online hit, with people from elsewhere in Europe, the US, and Africa expressing interest. 1,900 requests were made. That's over 3 times more than the actual number of the animals on the island. The challenge now is catching them. Next week, goat experts will travel to Alicudi to assess the situation. It's reported that capturing the goats will involve either large nets or luring them into enclosures with food. Once safe in holding pens, the animals will undergo medical tests to assess their health before being transported by boat to Sicily to a quarantine facility, before any successful adopters or goat guardians can take them home. The authorities hope to capture as many goats as possible before June, when tourism season begins.
That's report by Harry Bly. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting, and the producer was Isabella Jewell. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritz, and until next time, goodbye.